All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet!
Roll them!
Welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Editor-in-Chief Rich DeRees.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Contributing Writer Natasha Bogutsky. How's it going, Natasha?
It's not going too bad. This week was kind of slow in movie news, but we do have a great lineup for you today.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Of course, this past weekend is the 10th anniversary of the release of Iron Man and the launch of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which has really been a game changer in terms of how all studios approach their franchise material. And we are going to discuss that a little bit later on. We'll be joined by Film Buff Online comic book film editor William Gadavakis. He's a great friend and has a wealth of knowledge about the history of comic book films, what Marvel has done over the years, and also, like me, is a big comic book geek too, so we can bring that into the mix as well. But first, you know, we do want to hit a couple of news stories and talk about a couple of trailers really quick. First off is the news that the box office tracking for Solo, A Star Wars Story, is kind of improved over the past couple of weeks since we talked about it a month ago.
How much so?
Well, last month, they were talking about the film possibly having an opening weekend of about $150 million, which they said wasn't too good. They were expecting more. Well, now tracking has them expecting a little bit more, falling anywhere between $165 to $175 million.
That's not too bad.
No, it's a much, much improved number.
That's for opening weekend, right?
Yeah, that's just okay. The 4-day opening weekend over Memorial Day. It's not The Last Jedi or The Force Awakens numbers, but I believe that does put it ahead of the numbers for Rogue One's opening weekend.
And we all know what Rogue One did.
Rogue One did fairly well. I mean, it didn't do mainline Star Wars saga numbers, but it still did very respectable. I think possibly because people weren't sure what it was supposed to be as the first spinoff film from Star Wars.
Whereas with this, they've kind of already built themselves to the audience. This is what we can deliver with these side stories.
Mm-hmm. And I think people, you know, oh, Han Solo? Yeah, I know who that is.
Yeah.
I believe I've seen him in one or two of these films before.
At least.
Yes. And I know like a month ago, there was some concern over that tracking and people were talking about, well, we haven't really seen a whole lot of promotion for this film yet, and it's coming out in 2 months. And I think that was partly because, and Disney and Lucasfilm have never confirmed this, I think they were just kind of letting all the marketing for The Last Jedi run all the way through its release and into its release on home video, let that whole cycle run its course, and then really start pushing Solo.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to have played out over the last couple of weeks. Last Jedi came out. Is on the home video market now. Advertising for that has pretty much stopped. And right on cue, all the Solo advertising like kicked into high gear. So there, you know, the awareness factor is much higher now for Solo, and that's raising the box office projections. And I honestly don't expect that box office number to stick. I expect it to push upwards even higher.
Oh, of course. A lot of the films that have been coming out lately, their projected numbers have been off.
Yes. Oh my gosh, Black Panther blew, you know, their projections way out of the water.
Quiet Place
did. Even something like Super Troopers 2, you know, a crowdfunded movie as a comedy sequel to something that was from 17 years ago. They were, I think, projecting it at around 6 or 7 million, and that weekend it opened, came out at 15.7 million.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, pretty much almost quadrupling what it made in its crowdfunding. I think it did like 4.5 million for crowdfunding. And so that movie is in the black in terms of finances. And I'm sure there's somebody at Fox Searchlight going, and we didn't actually give them the money to do this because we're stupid. So
it's pure profit for them, though.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yeah. That whole thing. It was an amazing move. And this is something I'd love to talk about some other time. But the only two movies that I can think of, big theatrical films that got decent releases and everything that crowdfunded, were this and the Veronica Mars movie, correct? Can you think of anything else?
That got decent release?
Yes.
No, I can think of a few that didn't get decent release, but yeah, no, not like this.
Nothing that I can think of that was brought in with
I didn't know the Veronica Mars movie was crowdfunded.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Really? That was the first feature to, first kind of big feature with Hollywood names attached to it and everything that crowdfunded, and they hit their goal in less than 24 hours, I think. It was nuts, and everybody was like, what? Is this going to change Hollywood forever? And it hasn't.
Shame.
In a way, it is a bit of a shame, because sometimes it just shows that, filmmakers have faith in an idea and have faith that the public wants to see the idea more so than a bunch of studio executives with their business and marketing degrees that don't really understand
the fan base.
In both cases, there's, they had rabid fan bases. Super Troopers and the Broken Lizard Guides have a big fan base, thankfully, because of home video, and college students every year discover them, and their fan base just grows. Veronica Mars had a heck of a fan base, too, thanks to a lot of social media engagement on the part of Rob Thomas, the creator of the show, and Kristen Bell, the star. They were very active. And then you see studios not getting that. Maybe sometimes the talent understands the product better than their Ivy League marketing degree does. And that's the problem with a lot of Hollywood stuff right now, is they're marketing IP instead of marketing good stories and stuff like that, which, teaser, is exactly what Marvel Studios does, but they also care about story. And I think we're going to touch on that later. I know I have a note that I want to talk a little bit about Marvel and how they promote characters over having stars in their movies. Their movies have made people stars.
Oh, God, yeah.
Their movies have, movies have reignited some actors' stardom. But
Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell. Well, I think Kurt Russell's always been a star. At least to me, but
he dipped in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
You want to try that one again?
No. but we're really getting off on the solo tracking here.
Yes, get back to solo.
So I expect to see the solo numbers go up, maybe not quite break 200 million on its opening weekend, but come pretty darn close to it.
We can only hope.
True.
God knows what it What did Infinity War do?
Infinity War worldwide it did break $500 million opening weekend last weekend.
Didn't it do like 630 or something like that?
Yeah, 630, I think, 634 when all was said and done. It was ridiculous. I think when we were at Tribeca, when we were on a meal break, I was updating the box office story on Film Buff Online in a lovely burger joint on 23rd Street, New York. Well, I'm like, oh my God, holy crap.
We couldn't even fathom those numbers.
It was nuts. It was nuts. It was amazing. Again, just a testament to the 10 years of Marvel and what they've been able to do, which we'll be discussing in a little bit. But before that, though, tangentially, a Black Panther actor has just been added to the cast of a spy thriller that's going to star Diane Kruger. And that Black Panther actor is
Martin Freeman.
Martin Freeman, yes. He's also in, The Hobbit and the Sherlock series on BBC and a bunch of other things that you know and love him for. And Cargo coming up on Netflix in, I believe, a week or two, which we talked about last episode as something we saw at Tribeca. I enjoyed it a little bit more than you did, I believe.
Yeah, so if you would like to know our thoughts on that film, go back and listen to our Tribeca wrap-up episode.
Yes, that's our sneaky way of getting you to listen to more content. Anyways.
You're giving away the game.
Shh. Sorry. Anyways, Martin, according to The Hollywood Reporter, Martin Freeman will be playing Thomas, a former spy handler to Kruger's character, named Rachel, who is recruited by Israeli intelligence agency Mossad to go undercover in Tehran. He's trying to find where Rachel has disappeared to, and the only clue is a cryptic phone call she places to Thomas, who is summoned from Germany to Israel by the Mossad. So, that doesn't really tell us all that much.
Doesn't tell us what decade that this should be put into.
It's true. It does sound fairly vague. Like this could be in the 80s or it could be now. That's kind of fun, though. I would kind of enjoy a period set spy thriller. And
Didn't we get one with Beirut, sort of?
And we also got one with Red Sparrow. Maybe studios are kind of opening up their ideas about period flicks or not for spy thrillers. Again, we don't know if this one is, though, or not.
But the problem is after a while, the whole Cold War is going to burn out. I mean, it's not exactly a thriller. It's more of an action film, but Atomic Blonde.
True. Atomic Blonde. What's interesting about this, though, is this movie is being adapted from the Israeli book The English Teacher, which was written by former Israeli intelligence officer Yiftach Riker Atir and is based on the real-life story of Mossad operators. That sounds exciting to me.
That does. It sounds interesting, to say the least. I'm definitely interested. I'm going to be following it, and I will definitely try to see it when it comes out.
Definitely. This is, this is one I think, we're going to keep this on the radar for a while. And I'll be excited once it's made and we get to see a trailer.
Yes.
And speaking of trailers.
Yay. We're finally there.
And speaking of trailers, we'll be right back in just a moment with a look at a couple new trailers that dropped this week.
You from Virginia?
Ms. Bartle?
Is Brandon home?
He's out.
I'm just following up on a few things from Brandon's last post.
Has your son ever mentioned the name Daniel Murphy?
Listen, whatever your sale, mister, we don't want any.
Oh, I'm not a recruiter or anything like that, Ms. Bartle.
You had him already. You don't get to take him again. You understand? Thanks for looking.
You bet. We look out for each other.
Promise me you'll take care of him over there.
Yeah, of course. No.
And that was a few moments from The Yellowbirds, the first trailer for this new war movie that stars Ty Sheridan and Alden Ehrenreich from Solo, and Toni Collette, Jason Patrick, Jack Huston, and Jennifer Aniston.
I don't know what to say to this. Except stop getting me into war movies.
I know that's not your favorite genre. No. But this looks gripping and powerful and
I'm seeing
disturbing.
It. Yes.
Yeah, there's been a few films set in the Middle East during Desert Storm and the like and everything that's come since 9/11 that have looked very disturbing to me. Some of them are kind of rah-rah propaganda pieces almost that I would draw a parallel to war movies from 1941 through 1944, 45, while we were fighting World War II and immediately after. But there are some films that really kind of like examine what it does to the soldiers, things like that. And those are hard to watch, but I think they're also kind of important to watch. Films like The Hurt Locker and some other things.
I loved Hurt Locker. American Sniper, not all that... I didn't much care for it.
I had problems with it as a movie, but there became such this cult of personality around American Sniper that it was hard to criticize the movie for its faults as a movie without some people taking it as a criticism of the subject matter itself, which made conversation about that movie difficult at times.
Okay, this is definitely another podcast we need to talk about.
Yeah, because there's I know there was something I saw at the New York Film Festival back in 2007 that was really good, and that's something I would if we were having that discussion, I would want to go back and pull out and rewatch because that was a film that left me visibly shaken when I came out of the screening at the end of it, and I can't remember the name of it right now, and I feel really bad. But I'd have to go and pull my notes on that. But yeah, you're right. This is probably an interesting conversation for another podcast.
Write it down.
Okay. But in the meantime, though, The Yellowbirds. Not sure what the release date on this is, but keep an eye out for it. It looks like it's going to be a film that people are going to be discussing.
Do you think it'll be out in time for award season? The way it's
most
looking?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to say this is Oscar bait. I just think it's a good, strong, powerful movie without having that, look at these stars acting and how wonderful they are, and you should think about this for the Oscars. That I don't get that vibe from this movie. I just get the vibe that this is a raw, tough movie, and people are going to see it and respond accordingly.
Okay.
Moving on, our next trailer is something a little bit lighter.
There's been whispers. Got our commoners looking up, seeing hope.
If I may, I propose a bounty. 1,000 a week until he's caught or killed.
I've never seen anything like you.
You stare death in the face.
That's why I chose you.
You're not curious? He's under the hood.
He's obviously well-trained.
You flatter him. He's a smash-and-grabber, nothing more. Who do you think the thief is?
He's all of us.
You're an admirer.
He has his qualities. He's not you.
Are you sure?
And that was a few moments from the new Lionsgate film, which is a big screen adaptation of the CW's Arrow superhero show, but just set in medieval times. And it's called Robin Hood. Yeah, folks. I hope the guys at Lionsgate cut the CW a big fat check, because there is so much in this that is ripped off from Arrow. And I'm not just talking about, no, dumb. Arrow, the Green Arrow character, is always a modern day Robin Hood. I mean specific stylistic points that have been ripped off in this thing, you know, with the multiple Arrow shooting and stuff like that. There was some stuff, you know, and I'm a diehard CW superhero franchise fan. And there's just some stuff in there. I was like, yep, seen it. You know, that they directly lifting. And is it right, though, that a Robin Hood movie has to go back to one of the things that was inspired by the original Legend of Robin Hood and rip that off?
Well, I read an article about the Robin Hood film a few months ago or something like that, where they said that they were trying to make it hyper, and that the director saw Robin Hood more as a revolutionary than he did just someone who robbed from the rich to steal the robbed from the rich to feed the poor.
Well, that's a revolutionary idea at the time.
But
quite honestly,
he says
it's still a revolutionary idea now.
Yeah,
I went there.
Yeah, you did. No. He said that while that is a revolutionary idea, it's not something that lands your name in the history books as a legend.
I'm not sure I would totally agree with that. I think history is filled with people who advocated, and I hesitate to use this word because people like to use it as a pejorative, and I don't mean it as a pejorative, people who are social justice warriors, people who want equality for everybody, not just certain classes of people. Robin Hood is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Gandhi. Dare I say, this little guy from Bethlehem back about 2,000 years ago was also kind of big on that idea. But, you know, with all these historical examples, I certainly would say, oh, no, Robin Hood wouldn't have been a legend if he wasn't a buff action star. I think, you know, the idea of Robin Hood fighting for the poor and championing them and making sure that they are treated as humans and have, you know, enough of the necessities that we would feel are required to live a good life is something that certainly I think can be used to draw parallels today. And that could be a thematic portion of this film. I'm not getting it from the trailer. I'm just getting it as Guy Ritchie kind of directed Robin Hood. But it's
it
not
does
Guy,
feel
it's,
like
it's
that.
Not Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie already did his medieval legendary character movie, and that wasn't very good.
Wait, what was it?
The King Arthur one.
Oh, yeah. Didn't see it.
I'm a Guy Ritchie fan, and I'm like, nah, don't bother. Honestly, it was there was a couple of interesting visual moments, but beyond that, the script was a piece of garbage.
Mm. You know who I want to see do a Robin Hood film?
Who?
The guys from Doctor Who. Well, I would see.
They kind of did. There was the one episode where Peter Capaldi's doctor did meet Robin Hood.
No. I want to see them go off on their own little side adventure film. No doctor. Dare I say this? No Clara.
Oh.
Just Robin and his merry men. I would see that Robin Hood film.
That could be fun. I mean, I think those guys showed a lot of inventiveness in storytelling and stuff. That I think they could handle any kind of legend. But getting back to this, though.
I want it to be good.
I want it to be good.
I like Taron Egerton. I like Jamie Foxx.
Yeah. I
like Ben Mendelsohn.
Ben Mendelsohn. Hey, Ben Mendelsohn being a bad guy.
He's getting typecast.
Is it too early to ask, is Ben Mendelsohn the new Alan Rickman? He's got a Robin Hood movie now.
Let me think on that, and I'll let you know by the end of this podcast.
Okay. But going forward, though, this is something I'm kind of like leery about.
It also feels like some of the action shots. Sorry, Taron, we've seen you do them before in Kingsman.
Mm-hmm. We'll get more of an idea of how good or bad this movie's going to possibly be as it gets closer to its theatrical release date on November 21st. Let's just kind of pivot now to our last trailer that we have here. The Catcher Was a Spy.
You're an unusual man, Mr. Bird. Speaks seven languages. You're an athlete. You're more than up to the physical requirements of the job.
What job?
Since this war began, we have reason to believe the Germans are working on a fission bomb.
The scientist leading their atomic program is Werner Heisenberg. We must get to him and find out how close the Germans are to a bomb.
Welcome to the OSS, Mr. Berg. Millions of lives at stake. A 5% chance of losing the war to a weapon like this, you do what has to be done.
You can't allow yourself to be captured.
You know that I love you.
You brought me here to say goodbye?
I'll be back.
And those were the first moments from The Catcher Was a Spy, being released on June 22nd. I'm seeing this movie. The moment I saw Jeff Daniels pop up, I said I was in. And then I saw Pierfrancesco Favino, and I'm like, done.
Every edit in this trailer seems to reveal yet another great actor. It's like, oh, and here's Sienna Miller. And oh, here's Mark Strong. And here's Guy Pearce. And here's Paul Giamatti. And it's like,
and Tom Wilkinson.
Mark Strong. It's crazy. And I was like, oh my God, this is really good. And honestly, this amount of great acting talent, and I don't mean to make this sound like the slam it's going to sound, this amount of great acting talent surrounding Paul Rudd, and Paul Rudd's a good actor, so I don't want that to sound like a slam.
Oh yeah, he is.
Is this Paul Rudd's kind of move to out of being, you know, comedic and the romantic comedy doofus and into this is kind of his first grab at more serious roles and hoping to be taken more seriously, do you think?
I think he knows how to bounce back and forth. Yes, when he did the Baz Luhrmann, William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, he was trying to infuse his performance there with comedy. But
I forgot about that. Much like I try to forget about anything Baz Luhrmann does.
Stop right there. You and I will have this talk off podcast.
And there will probably be things thrown.
There will be blood.
Now, that's a good movie.
Yes, it is. There was also, he did an adaptation of The Great Gatsby, not the Baz Luhrmann version, but he did a version with Paul Sorvino's daughter.
Mia Sorvino?
Yes. God, he's worked with both of them.
Wow.
I just realized that. Where he played Nick Carraway.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't a bad adaptation. I just wasn't a big fan of it. His performance was definitely good, though. And when he played the teacher in Perks of Being a Wallflower, it was more of a dramatic role than it was comedic. He really didn't infuse that with any comedy.
I'll give you that. But overall, that movie is kind of tonally, it's a light drama. It's not a heavy, it's not as heavy as this looks to be. It's not heavy and serious and po-faced.
That is true. I think he has that in him, but he is so used to being looked at as a comedic actor that he hasn't had a lot of chances in order to flex that muscle.
Okay.
But coming out of Avengers, he's now more of a bigger top star, I guess you could say, because of Ant-Man. And therefore, opportunities are now presenting themselves to him instead of him going out and searching them.
That's actually a great way to wrap up our trailer segment and kind of tease what we're going to be talking about next, in that the Marvel Studio films have launched a lot of careers or given a lot of careers some boosts into new and different directions. And that's just one of the many things that we're going to be talking about in terms of Marvel Studios with our special guest, Film Buff Online comic book movie editor, William Gadavakis, in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Years ago this weekend, fledgling Marvel Studios released Iron Man, a big-budget superhero film featuring a second-tier character from Marvel Comics' stable and starring an actor who was just coming out of years of very public personal problems. A gamble, to say the least, but a gamble that paid off in spades as Marvel's Cinematic Universe's series of interconnected franchises has reaped the studio billions at the box office and has fundamentally changed the way all studios approach their own intellectual properties and franchises. Joining us now via phone is Film Buff Online comic book film editor William Gadavakis. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, welcome everybody. How's everybody doing?
We're doing great. Thanks.
And just to let you know, my last name is Gadavakis.
Sorry.
We've only known each other for like close to 15, 20 years. That's
shame. You know,
it took me about 23 to actually learn how to pronounce it, so it's okay.
Okay. So I got 7 to go.
Yeah, I got... Got a little leeway there.
Okay, awesome. Thanks. 10 years ago, when all of this started, Bill, did you actually expect Marvel to be at this point in terms of success and popularity, or did you think it was not going to be as well received as it was?
Oh, well, I'm glad you let it put like a nice, easy question to start off with. That's good. To be honest with you, I knew there was a market for the comic book movie. Up to this point, we had success for like the X-Men and Spider-Man and stuff like this. So, you know, I knew there was going to be a success. Like, having a second-tier character become the third highest-grossing domestic film of all time? No. Have a film make $1 billion faster than anything else? No. I knew it was going to be successful, but not the massive amount of success that it's had to this point so far.
So we're certainly not seeing any superhero franchise fatigue at this point, are we?
Yeah, and I'm also glad that we're also not seeing any more articles saying about, hey, we're having superhero franchise fatigue. It's like, it seems like it's very strong, it's very doing very well, and it's going to be here for at least the foreseeable future, not for to stay. So, yeah, as long as it keeps, like I said, as long as it keeps making money, they're going to keep on making them. So, and you know, they're making money hand over fist, so we're going to be seeing these for a long time.
Mm-hmm, definitely. But looking back, I remember thinking... It was the Monday or the Tuesday after Iron Man opened, and Marvel was having their quarterly earnings call for their shareholders and everything, and that's basically where Kevin Feige announced, yeah, that tag scene at the end of Iron Man from this weekend, that means our films are going to kind of collide, and all these characters are going to come together in an Avengers film 2 years down the road. And, you know, they kind of laid that groundwork out for what we became... Yeah, what we now know is phase one. I remember thinking, wow, that's bold and ambitious. I'm excited by this. The only thing I see is possibly hurting this. I think everybody's going to want to see more Iron Man, obviously. A new Hulk, a new take on the Hulk is a good idea. The Captain America, I think everybody's going to love. The only thing I thought of as being maybe a hard sell on the public was Thor.
And yet Thor was actually a massive success.
Mm-hmm.
But you had Kenneth Branagh directing it, so well, you have some really good backing.
It was some time before they announced Kenneth Branagh directing Thor, though. So at the time, Thor, I thought, was the wild card for me. What was your first thoughts, Bill, when they announced all this?
Well, first of all, like, outside of, like, everything, like, as a comic book fan, this is like a dream come true, because Marvel Comics was the first real comic book company, like, in a print form, to actually have the characters interrelate together in the same comic book. You know, they all lived in New York. You can see the Fantastic Four hanging out with Spider-Man and stuff like this. So seeing it on the screen was, like, exciting for me as a fan. As they're laying out, they already had a Hulk film out that came out, like, not that long ago. And so they're revamping it, and usually when we revamp that quick, it doesn't turn out that well. I was a little concerned about that. Thor, I think, was actually, like, a little bit dicey for me, too. And it seems like they actually had a problem with that a little bit, too. I mean, like, all the movies have made money, but it seems like Thor, they finally got Thor right with Thor Ragnarok. Mm-hmm. The first two movies are kind of like, the first movie I like a lot. Second movie, not so much. But the third one, it seems like they found, like, the right vehicle for the character, like a goofy kind of, like, God kind of thing going on. But yeah, but the way they sold Thor in the first movie was, you know, fish off water, like, you're viewing the world through his eyes. It's a story of redemption. He's an arrogant guy. He's trying to learn to become a better person. That's the universal story. You know, you have movies that don't have people with capes that are very successful with that kind of plot line.
Mm-hmm.
So they took a really good tack on it, and here we are.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the key, I think, to Marvel's strategy. And this is something Natasha and I briefly brushed on earlier in the podcast, that I said, you know, we're going to put a pin in and get back to. It's the fact that the Marvel franchises are dealing with characters and not about stars. It's a fundamental shift away from, like, 90s blockbuster thinking. And the characters are the stars of the stories and the films, not necessarily Robert Downey Jr. or Hemsworth or, you know, whomever.
Yeah. And also, it's something that you don't actually expect from comic book movies, like themes. Like, you know, stuff that people who have never read a comic book could identify with. You know, Iron Man, he's a guy who lived his life, like, you know, as a playboy and selling arms to people, and he didn't care. But he has this big life-changing event, and he realizes his path on is wrong, and he tries to become a better person. That's, you could put, like, Tom Cruise behind a bar, and that's the same kind of, like, plotline kind of thing.
Just substitute deadly weapons for cocktail drinks.
Exactly.
Well, I think it also helps performance that they cast people who are almost, life imitates art in a way. Iron Man in the comics had at points PTSD, was an alcoholic. He had his problems. And to cast Robert Downey Jr. in that role, knowing that he could bring that to the character, it would be understated, but it would be there.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, like, I feel like I have to defend RDJ a little bit, but he's a great actor.
Oh, yes, he is.
He was a great actor even before the problems, and this was probably, like, why his life was so tragic, and why his second act coming back into prominence and becoming Iron Man is such a great story. Because he was awesome in Chaplin. I think he was nominated for an Oscar.
Yes, and that's still one of my favorite films.
Less than Zero, he was, like, the best part of that movie. Mm-hmm. He was always the best part of, like, really, really maybe not so good movies, and also good parts of great movies too. Mm-hmm. He came in at a time that Marvel and him met at the time, like, when he was a risk guest to be cast because of all his, like, drug problems, but, like, they were looking for somebody who could actually really do the job well, that they could probably get for cheap, more or less. So, like, they came together. It was a perfect synergy, you know, at the same, like, right at the right perfect time. And, you know, I think it's like, it's kind of like, if that magic didn't happen, then, you know, who knows? We might not be, like, talking about spoilers for Infinity War or anything like that, you know? It's just like magic happened there. So it's kind of indescribable. It's like magic luck happened there. Marriage of Robert Downey Jr. and Marvel Comics at the time.
Yeah, definitely, you know, the material. I even remember when they cast him as Tony Stark, my first thought was like, oh, if they do a sequel and they do Demon in the Bottle, he's going to be great for that. You know, it showed a certain forward thinking, I think.
Yeah, and one thing I like about Marvel, I'm not saying this just because they send me a check, of course. they play with expectations, and they give you something different, but it's just as good, if not better, than what you expect. Everybody expected Demon in a Bottle, but we still haven't gotten that yet. But we got the post-invasion New York PTSD Tony Stark,
which is
much more interesting, much more fascinating, and much more in like Downey's real base to play. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a much interesting and more longer lasting kind of plot line or character arc than just having him have to battle alcoholism, you know, because like that's pretty much like it's a serious problem, of course, but it's not something you can sustain over more than one movie. It's basically if he comes to an end and he gets better, if he goes back off the wagon, it's like kind of backsliding. But PTSD, there's no way to actually do that. And it's always a part of his character. And it's always there. If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. No, they even brought it up actually in Infinity War, how he said that Thanos had been in his head since New York. So it's still there, even though it's now gone to the back of his head.
Mm-hmm. It still comes to the foreground in his thoughts at times. And
which is now very prevalent given the ending of the film.
Yeah. And even more than that, it influences actions. It influences his characterization and like this stuff like this. Like you could tie it his behavior in
Ultron.
Captain America: Civil War.
Or his behavior in Spider-Man: Homecoming. Even.
Mm. Yep.
That's a credit to some of the long-term planning they've had at Marvel, and of course to Robert Downey Jr. And I'm sure he's a smart enough actor. He's probably given his feedback about, hey, can we continue this? And I'm sure he's had some input altogether in the course of Tony Stark over all of these films.
Yeah. Well, I think Shane Black directing Iron Man 3 shows exactly his input, because I think he had a lot to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So but it's another credit to Marvel that they actually are listening to him and, if it makes sense, going forward with it. So,
If only Robert Downey Jr. had stood up for Edgar Wright.
Yeah. Oh, the first Ant-Man movie was kind of like an Edgar Wright movie, not directed by Edgar Wright.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
Because it's you could tell all the, his style of the jump cuts and stuff like this. And the scenes are still in there. It's just that you don't have the quick jump cuts that he's used for. And that kind of took me off the movie a little bit, because I could see what Edgar Wright would have done there. Okay. And this is definitely in there for that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And no offense to Peyton Reed. I think he did a great job. It's just you could see the shelves that Edgar Wright built to put his toys on. If I could be vague and not really clear on my metaphor.
No. I get what you're saying. I mean, even there's a point where Edgar Wright had done that special effects test with Ant-Man, fighting the two guys, and he's running along the barrel of the gun and everything. And that's quoted almost verbatim in the actual movie. So, it's hard not to see his fingerprints all over that. And that's what actually makes me interested for Ant-Man and the Wasp, because this time it's Peyton Reed out there on having to do it on his own. And I think that's where we're really going to see the proof of, whether this line of films will fly on its own or not.
Yeah. And again, it's not exactly he's going to be, he has the first one as kind of like the tether. So he's not going to go completely away from that. It's not going to be Down with Love with, Ant-Man and Wasp.
Which I would so watch. I love Down with Love. You know that.
Yeah, the moment you brought it up, I went, oh, God, in the back of my head, here we go. You're going to send Rich off.
Yeah, I know Rich's triggers. So I could go a whole 5 hours here just throwing lobs over the net so you can spike them.
Well, to tangent just for a second, him and a friend of ours, we were ripping him last night about Buckaroo Banzai.
Because you're awful people. Stop it.
It's not a good movie.
Does Rich like that movie? Wow, I wouldn't have guessed. I think he's legally mandated to have every fifth Facebook post about it. So, but getting back to the Ant-Man comment, you're going to have the same kind of humor in there. You're going to have the same kind of rapport with all the characters. So it's not going to be completely free of Wright's influence in a way, but it's going to be interesting to see if how much of Wright's carries over to the sequel, or is this going to be more organic Peyton Reed kind of stuff. And, be interesting to see. So the trailers look good. So Marvel has, you always say, I don't know how Marvel's going to do this, and they always do it. So it's kind of going to be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. And it definitely looks, as everybody has been calling it, like a nice sorbet after Infinity War. We need something a little lighter, a little bit more fun.
Yeah, a nice sorbet or a fistful of Prozac. I don't know. It's one or the other.
Why not both?
Yeah, the Prozac mixed in with the sorbet and makes it easier to go down. Yes.
So here's a question about Ant-Man and the Wasp. Do you think it's going to take place before or after the events of Infinity War?
I believe it has officially been said, if I'm not mistaken, that it is before Infinity War.
Okay.
How far before? I don't know. I'm kind of expecting maybe perhaps like what I don't know how spoilers we could get. Whatever happens at the end of Infinity War is going to happen at the end of that movie as well, so to speak.
I sort of think they might hold any Infinity War ending impact on Ant-Man and the Wasp to either Avengers 4 right at the beginning or maybe a
post-credit scene,
yeah, where, you know, some people walk into a room and Paul Rudd goes, hey, and then something happens to that other person.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, yes, as well.
I just want to know what happened to Clint. He's my favorite male Avenger.
Yeah.
He's off playing house with his wife.
Yes.
That doesn't help me know if they got out.
Trust me, he'll be back.
Yeah. Yeah, because, like, you know, they need to have somebody to fight the next war, so to speak. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I think it'll be back. Yeah. So.
Well, that's what they got Captain Marvel for.
Yes. And one thing I have to say about this, I don't know, like, how deep we're going to dive into the whole Infinity War thing. That is one of the best setups of a character ever, I think, personally. Oh, God, everything's going to chaos. The world's going to, and I'm going to curse for the first time now, the world's going to shit. We got to get somebody to fix this. Who do we get? Who do we know? The person whose movie's coming up next year, Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like basically it sets up like, okay, this is an important character. This is like somebody we need to watch. We need to find out more about this person. And that's brilliant because now I'm like, okay, I want to see how the movie plays out. My level of excitement has gone up a little bit for that movie. By the way, they sold it at the end of the Infinity War.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
Samuel L. Jackson with his mother. I'm really glad that they added that.
Delightfully self-aware.
Yes. It's Samuel Jackson being Samuel Jackson at that point, not Nick Fury.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I like about Marvel is the fact that they're so well established now that they can kind of jump back and forth in time even. They can have a movie like Ant-Man and the Wasp take place in front of, chronologically, the movie that preceded it. And then they can have... they can tease for Captain Marvel, then have the Captain Marvel movie take place in the 90s, and then everybody's back for Avengers 4, whatever the hell they're going to call it.
Yes.
And it kind of feeds things in. Like you said before, it's just comic book continuity and interconnectedness done on a cinematic level, which, as he said, no one's ever done that before.
Yeah. And a lot of trust in the audience, too, because, you know, critics might say, like they're getting to the point where, like, they're too much in the weeds. They have too much continuity and stuff like that and going back and forth. Obviously, the gross is kind of like either say that's not that big of a problem or it's not keeping the new people away. So they have, like, a lot of trust in, like, you know, the people who see it. Either they've seen it, all of them, and they're following along and they're going to be okay with it. Or the new people coming in, they give them enough information that they're up to speed and they could jump on the train and enjoy the ride.
Mm-hmm. And honestly... Honestly, it's, what, 2-3 movies a year to keep track of? I think most people can handle that, you know, if they're watching serialized television shows like Game of Thrones or the CW superhero stuff. Any hour-long drama now is pretty much, like, serialized. So if they can, you know, track 3, 4, 5 of their favorite shows and keep all those plot lines in their head, they can free up, you know, a couple of brain cells for 6 to 7 hours worth of movie continuity a year.
Yeah.
That's been an argument that has never really struck me as logical.
Or for us Doctor Who fans.
Even worse, yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, but that's Hollywood's mind speak. You know, like, oh, women can open a superhero action movie. Well, Wonder Woman proved that differently. Mm-hmm. Well, a superhero movie with an all primarily African-American, African cast, black cast. Oh, that'll never work. Bam, Black Panther, like one of the biggest films of all time. The conventional wisdom of Hollywood isn't very wise sometimes, so it's kind of like, it's good to see, like, you know, like Marvel seems to actually kind of like put that aside. Screw that. We're going to give good stories to the people, and the people are responding.
But they always make sure that they take the time to write a good story in order to make those films successful. Black Panther is good, not just because of its casting, primarily African-American actors, but we also see how African-Americans are treated in America versus how they're treated in Africa. And we get that,
yeah,
we get that tension back and forth of respect for the culture.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a great movie, period, regardless of like that, but they are willing to address those kind of issues. Mm-hmm. And make it a plot point. And
I was going to say, that's why I think Killmonger is one of the best Marvel villains, because he actually has a point of view. It's rooted in the political realities of, you know, the last 20, 30 years. And I think that, you know, how that plays out is, you know, it just kind of grounds that in a way that sometimes it's a little hard to connect, you know, to a villain that's just another evil businessman with an evil businessman plot to use technology to get
Lex
more
Luthor?
Money.
Yeah.
Well, no, not Lex Luthor. Obviously, that's the Lex Luthor MO. But we saw that in Iron Man. We've seen it in the first Ant-Man. We've seen it in
Second Iron Man.
Spider-Man Homecoming.
Let's stop you right there.
Yeah. That's okay, Rich, calm down.
No. Spider-Man Homecoming is something completely different. And
yeah,
Michael Keaton, it's not about money and all that. For him, it's about his family. And mm-hmm. he is an honorable villain. He's not a villain. Yeah. He's just a man trying to do the best he can for his family.
He's an antagonist.
And I will agree with Natasha with contradicting her at the same time.
Good for it.
Money is a part of that, but it's not him trying to get rich. It's about him. The government came in and took away his way to put food on his family's table, and not only his whole crew, like mm-hmm. bang, like that, like a streaming income was taken away for no good reason, and he has nothing to do about it. Okay, well, fine, then I'm going to do this then. So there, it's not just like him becoming, I want to own Bolivia. It's more like, okay, like I gotta feed my family. And you know what? If the government's not going to help me, fine. Then I'll go against them. So it's kind of like there's a different layer of that. It's like more nuanced than just simply him like wanting to like run the stock market or anything like that.
Okay, fair enough.
I do agree, though, that Killmonger is probably one of the best villains that Marvel has written for the same reasons that Rich said. Plus, I like the idea that in the end, there was no leeway to his death. He said, no, I want to go. I'm not going to change who I am.
And like the last couple villains that Marvel's had have really they've really stepped up their villain game, so to speak. Long gone are the days of Malekith, who's like, I'm evil because I'm evil, and I'm going to hire a Doctor Who actor who's just phoning it in to just not impress anybody at all.
And they wasted that actor.
I don't think Eccleston was phoning it in so much as he didn't have anything to work with. I think he probably had a better earlier draft of a script, and the character just wound up getting watered down in favor of other stuff in the movie, and he just basically like a glorified prop at that point. And I felt bad watching that movie.
I'm going to say this in all jest, Rich, you ignorant slut. He was promoting a Shakespeare thing he was doing. I think, I don't know if it's Richard III or Hamlet in like that's aired on the BBC. They interviewed him about this, and he actually came out and admitted, so like, yeah, I did it for the paycheck. I did that. I did G.I. Joe for the paycheck. And he seems kind of embarrassed about it, but yeah, he admitted he was checked out.
Okay.
So it's like
I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt there, I guess.
Yeah. No, when he breaks my heart, I'm going to make sure it stays broken.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I'm going to make sure everybody's hearts breaks at the same time because I'm bitter and petty like that.
And now I want to skip 9.
But nonetheless, you do have the important point of like the writing wasn't there to help him out. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, I was like they're saying like, you know, like, hey, we got Eccleston. We don't really have to write that well-defined villain because he's going to act the heck out of it. And we don't need to worry about that. Like Vulture in Spider-Man Homecoming, more layers on it than you really expect. And like, a lot of sympathy there.
Michael Keaton delivers.
Mm-hmm.
Thanos. In my review, I love Thanos. Thanos is like a guy, you'd be right with him because his plan makes sense right up to the point when he's killing half of every living thing in the entire universe. That's where the plan goes off the rails. But he believes in it so much, and he's not doing it to be megalomaniacal or because he loves the living embodiment of death. He's doing it because this is the way he believes the universe is going to survive. Poverty's going away and everything becomes an idyllic paradise with just getting rid of half the people who are alive. Mm-hmm. And that's a strong motivation. When your villain has a great, strong motivation, your entire movie is better because of it.
Oh, true. Definitely. I think the reason Marvel's villain game is so strong lately kind of ties back to 2015 when Kevin Feige kind of had that tussle with Ike Perlman about control of the studio versus control over the TV side of Marvel Productions. And, you know, he kind of now, Kevin Feige just reports directly to the honchos at Disney. And that's around the time that they dissolved the creative committee that they were using of Marvel Comics writers and editors who were coming in and giving feedback on the films. And now we have much stronger villains because, for whatever reason, it seems, perhaps the creative committee was not emphasizing the role of the villains in these stories.
Yep. And, like, you know, like, the rise to power of Kevin Feige is, like, you know, worthy of, like, you know, a primetime soap opera kind of thing. You know, first he was there with Avi Arad. And then, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Avi Arad kind of, like, got shuffled to the side.
Yeah.
And then he was dealing with, like, Ike Perlmutter. And then he got separated from him. Then he had the Marvel guys. And then the Marvel guys went away. And now it's like, he's got all the power in his hands now. Blah, ha, ha, ha.
But blah, ha, ha, ha in a good way.
Oh, yeah. Because
like, he's delivering the goods.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, in any job, but especially in Hollywood, if you are delivering the money into the corporation, you will get a lot of leeway.
I mean, you know, I went back and looked this up. When the Marvel Creative Committee was dissolved, Captain America Civil War had already been shot. Doctor Strange was in pre-production. And pretty much everything after that has been where we've seen this marked increase in Marvel's villain game, quote unquote. I mean, I came across a quote from James Gunn who said that the creative committee suggested getting rid of the 1970s soundtrack for the first Guardians movie, which is like, guys, that's the emotional core of the movie is those songs. You know, you might as well just rip the heart out of the film if you were to do that.
Yeah. And like, I would love to be like the fly on the wall of like, you know, that conversation because like, I'm sure like once I thought like, these guys are trying to make sure the characters are good. Why are they telling you about the soundtrack? And the other people are saying like this, nobody's going to listen to the characters. The soundtrack is there. And obviously one side was more correct than the other one because, you know, obviously the soundtrack enhances the film more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
I would love to see some interviews with some of the folks from the creative committee to talk about their work there and, you know, see if there would be on, if they, you know, if they would honestly react to, okay, in retrospect, was lifting the 70s soundtrack out of leaving the 70s soundtrack in Guardians. Was that a good idea or not? Do you feel bad that basically Edgar Wright found he couldn't work with you guys and that's one of the reasons he left? You know, how do you guys feel about that? You know, I would really be interested in seeing if they would be honest and open about that.
I would say probably not. Because like, not in a bad way, but like, well, read every Kevin Feige statement he's ever had.
Mm-hmm.
He has like professional stuff like that, and you know, you might have to read between the lines to get what he's saying, but he's not going to come out and tell you like, oh yes, we are definitely doing this. Yes, we're doing that. Case in point, the Eternals. Like everybody says, like Eternals in production. His statement on it officially was, yeah, that's one of the ones we were looking at. Okay, that means. What? That means, do you have people writing it? Do you have like people thinking about it? It's on a big marker board in your office. What exactly does that mean? I mean, are you getting crews together to make a set? So it's like he's the master of like the vague kind of confirming, but not really confirming, kind of like giving himself an out kind of thing. So like that's probably like, you know, why he does so well. I mean, and that's why, like, there's still an air of mystery about the Marvel films. I mean, a lot of stuff in Infinity War we had no idea about. Yeah,
we had ideas, but we didn't know.
Well, no, there was a few things that totally took even, you know, seasoned journalists like us, by, you know, a nerd and, you know, news watchers like us by surprise.
Particularly one where there was audible holy shits dropped from the entire audience.
That was me.
No, it wasn't just you.
I know.
I mean, you did too, but... I think we all did.
Well, but in Rich's defense, he also drops holy shit during Melissa McCarthy movies and like, you know, like I think
wait, which
I think,
one?
but all of them.
Whenever her husband shows up and that little cameo role he always seems to have.
Yeah.
It's like, holy shit, that guy's still rocking that mustache. God bless him.
And you got to watch like a Benji movie with him because it's like, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit.
I can't believe Joe Camp went there. That will be the only time I will ever reference Joe Camp.
Yes.
Yeah. Good God.
We'll save that and put that on like your tombstone. I can't believe Joe Camp went there.
So future generations can just walk by and scratch their head. I have no idea what the hell that means.
What? Yes.
Perplexing the planet for generations to come.
That is a great epitaph.
Well, let's get into that then a little bit. The future of Marvel. We know that.
I thought for a second you said Joe Camp. I have no idea. I'm on the weeds of Joe Camp movies, so okay.
His magnum opus was definitely Oh Heavenly Dog.
you'll be hard pressed to find a better dog director than Joe Camp. And that will go on my tombstone. And hopefully we're buried close to each other, so they'll confuse people at the same time.
Oh yeah,
the double MacGuffin.
No, not the double MacGuffin. Everybody knows that Joe Camp movie is garbage. Oh. Oh wow!
But anyway,
even Dennis Miller is like, you guys are way off track right now.
Cha cha, come on,
babe. I mean it. Anyways. The future of Marvel, Kevin Feige has said, hey, we've got about 20 movies that we're looking, 20 movies that we're looking at. So that kind of plans them out to what, 2025, 2027 at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Going forward, just in the short term into phase four, do they stay as interconnected as they have been or do they kind of branch back out and kind of be their own things with just brief mentions back and forth, do you think?
Here's my theorem on phase four and beyond. I think, I think it's going to be like a different chapter. Well, I think it's a lot of the things like, there's going to be like, the Eternals are supposed to be in production. And like, granted, it's so similar to the Inhumans, which has been in production before, like,
Well, development.
Yeah. They have like a head start on that already. There's going to be sequels to some of the movies that have already come. A lot, I think, will be depending on like, the sale of Fox to Marvel. I think that would be like a perfect way for them to have a brand new phase without having to like rely on the old favorites as like a backbone, like reliable. Because if you're going to tell me Marvel Studios is going to do an X-Men movie and a Fantastic Four movie and like, as part of phase four, I'm there. Basically just to see how different it's going to be. Is it what did they do right? What did they do different? And stuff like this. So that could be like a brand new chapter. I don't really see them actually like going back to Thor, Iron Man, Captain America. Granted, like, unless like they do a recasting, it's like there's some kind of like magical MacGuffin to bring that up there again in Avengers 4 that like, makes Robert Downey Jr. the same age he was when he was on Saturday Night Live. Okay, maybe then, but like they're at the end of their contracts. They are getting kind of like long in the tooth, at least Downey is. And like, so like, I don't see them continuing on as the backbone of the cinematic universe from here on out. The best idea would be like, say the Fox things coming in because they already have a built-in audience. If not, it's like, it's probably gonna be like Wild Wild West. Let's throw it up on the wall and see what sticks. Like Black Panther could be the new backbone to the thing because you definitely know the audience is there and they'll come back again and again and again. Like use that as a springboard for other movies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's like everybody's saying like this is the end of the first chapter of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I'm taking them at their word. I think what we're going to see after this is going to be in a wider scale, bigger and different than we had before. They're not going to leave Black Panther sequel money on the table. So there's going to be a sequel to that. There's probably going to be a sequel to Doctor Strange. There's probably going to be a sequel to Captain Marvel that's good. Maybe another Ant-Man sequel and stuff like this. So there's going to be sequels in there of stuff we've seen before. Mm-hmm. But the backbone of the entire phase will be different, whether that's the Fox movies or more homegrown in-house properties. I think that's what we could expect.
If, for whatever reason, they decide, and I don't see it happening, the Fox merger goes through, and they suddenly decide, well, we're going to keep X-Men off to the side in its own pocket universe, or maybe Fantastic Four off on its own side pocket universe. Who knows? The Fox merger gets derailed by federal regulators or something like that, because it is still up in the air. It's going through this regulatory process. What characters do they have to bring forward as originals to lead movies at this point, do you see?
Here's the thing, because like basically, like I personally do not think that Guardians of the Galaxy was going to be, a big enough to actually boom at the box office kind mm-hmm. of thing like that. They do have a skill of taking like lower tier characters of the universe and making them superstars. I mean, Black Panther has like, you know, a lot of like fan base behind him coming in there, and he means a lot to a lot of people. So he's like kind of the outlier. But like I said, the Eternals, if they're done right, that might be something to consider. I'm trying to think, like, what else is out there? I remember, like, I did a whole, like, big, long list of it. Like, maybe try to do, like, maybe a Thunderbolts kind of thing, if they could try to get that. They have Zemo in there, have certain other villains who kind of, like, survive, something like that. I'm trying to think, like, what else, like, they'd actually have to be able to do that. Like, maybe try, like, some of the newer initiatives, like America or the new Miss Marvel. More of the culturally diverse characters that came in over the last, like, say, 10 years in the comic books. Try to make them into movies. Like, some of the more newer characters, I think like Marvel's comic book site has been like really having, you know, even though like people on the internet saying like, social justice, blah, 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 they've been really good with like creating interesting, diverse characters in the comic books. And I think a lot of them will translate well to the screen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Marvel's a little hamstrung because I think there's, you know, some strong characters in Daredevil, Luke Cage, you know, the whole Luke Cage, Jessica Jones thing, where all of those characters could have very easily translated onto the big screen, but they're kind of, I don't want to say ghettoized down in Netflix land, but, you know, they're off in their own separate thing doing the Netflix shows. And
No. Let me stop you there. The ghetto for, like, Marvel is the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and, like, the ABC television network. That's a bad neighborhood.
I agree.
The Netflix is the traditional neighborhood. And the high end like real estate is the movies.
Okay.
If we're going to be totally culturally insensitive when it comes to the Marvel film universe.
Okay.
Which I guess I just did. So.
All right. Awesome.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, and there are characters like Moon Knight. I think would probably work better on Netflix in mm-hmm. that milieu than they would on the big screen. They've got Cloak and Dagger out on Freeform as a TV series. Have they started to spread their IP a little too wide to be able to fully support the needs of new characters and new IP for the film side of things?
Well, remember back when they actually made the deal to actually have their own studio, every press release said we have 5,000 individual IP that we could use. Mm-hmm. And granted, some of that IP is Forbush Man or Slapstick.
Hypno Hustler.
Yeah. Oh, if they make a Hypno Hustler movie, I'm going to like I'll be there with my bell bottom jeans on and my, you know, I'll probably even bring out my leisure shoes to do that.
I don't want to see that.
Oh, I do.
but like, you know, like
what about Jennifer Walters?
A She-Hulk movie?
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see that.
That would be great, and I think that would get them around the whole a Hulk movie has to be distributed by Columbia. issue that they have.
And they already have an actress. Angie Harmon has gone on like social media years ago saying that she wants the role. I mean, mm-hmm. granted, like it's like ageism is a thing in Hollywood, and she is not exactly the youngest actress in the world. But, you know, if you're playing a lawyer, older the better kind of thing. I think that would be a good thing to do. Like, you know, like it's, you know, stuff like that. Depending on like how like Captain Marvel does, maybe spin off like the Kree War kind of thing, or Kree Skrull War kind of stuff like that, the big epic in space. Yeah, it's like kind of like, you know, there's a lot of possibilities there because they seem to be able to find like the gold in all their concepts.
Mm-hmm. They did already sort of introduce the idea of Planet Hulk and Thor Ragnarok. So wouldn't it be kind of natural to follow that up with maybe a She-Hulk?
Yeah, you seem to be really into She-Hulk, and I'm right there with you.
Dan Slott's run on it.
It's just the idea of they already sort of have the setup, so why not do it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like it would be easy to fit into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, too. Some of the origins there's enough difference between like the movies and the comic books that you can't actually make it work. The comic book origin of Jen Walters, which, in case anybody who doesn't collect comic books and are still listening, cousin of Bruce Banner gets shot by mobsters, needs an emergency blood transfusion. Bruce is there, gives her blood. She becomes a Hulk because of that, but keeping her own wits about her. That could be easily done. It fit in like seamlessly, and like a lot of drama and pathos about the whole, oh, I have to save her, but I'm giving her a curse kind of thing like going on like that. Yeah, that could work very well as a movie. But like getting back to the original thing about Spring Too Thin, I think, like I said, like there's a big board in Marvel Studios offices, and they have, okay, these characters are ABC TV worthy. These characters are Netflix worthy. These are movie worthy. And I think they have a cast system of their characters done there. So I think if they didn't have like that kind of organization of like inner hierarchy of characters, they might be spreading self thin. But like, you know, I think there's like a division of importance there, if that makes any sense.
No, I get what you're going at. I tend to think that maybe they're just like, if you come to me with a good movie pitch for whatever character, we'll make the movie. If you come to me with a good TV pitch for that character, we'll do the TV show instead.
Also, I think a lot of this has to do actually with like cost. Like, you know, you could make Iron Fist cheaper on television than you would in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might not suck anymore. But like, that Iron Fist could work on television with minimal with the smaller budget that Netflix allows.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was surprised to see Ghost Rider in like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because that's CGI heavy, and you usually don't get that kind of CGI heavy in like a TV series that's kind of like middling in the actual kind of like ratings.
I just assumed that to save money, they actually set somebody's head on fire every time Ghost Rider was on screen.
See, I think that if the actual if the actual skull looked like a skull,
mm-hmm.
but the skull had that kind of like a distorted kind of skull look. So unless like they found the actor who actually has the most oblong skull in Hollywood, it's probably CGI.
Okay.
But it's, you know, that's the kind of thing I think like they do have properties. They have a lot of properties that haven't been like properly themed. And don't forget, like, there are a lot of characters in the movies we've already seen who are in the background who could probably have their own movie. I want to see a Black Widow movie before, like, you know, like Scarlett Johansson's 79 years old and like flying with a Ritter Bite Walker kind of thing at people.
I think that Marvel is definitely working on a Black Widow film. There was a rumor report recently that they've interviewed over 60 directors for this thing. Which sounds crazy to me.
65, so yeah, 65.
60, 65. That sounds like a crazy number. That they should have had a short list, you know, before they started this process, if that number is accurate. But that the fact that they're actively looking at doing a Black Widow movie, probably after Red Sparrow did so well at the box office this past summer, I can see why.
We saw the trailers for that and went, that's a Black Widow movie we ought to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very Black Widow-y. So, and like, I didn't actually follow how well it did in the box office. That's a good sign there. This is the rumor they have to 65 for this one. Who knows how many they had when they're doing Guardians of the Galaxy? They might have had like 70. Before they got on James Gunn. They cast their net wide. Generally established really director that worked on a Marvel film, arguably Kenneth Branagh.
Mm-hmm.
Jon Favreau did some stuff before that, but, and Joss Whedon was mostly television, but like you have the Russo brothers, you have James Gunn, who's mostly like, you know, kind of like he came up through Troma.
Mm-hmm. The Russo brothers were all TV.
Yeah. You had Peyton Reed had a little bit more of a career for him, but not really in like action movies. You had Alan Taylor. He was from television. He was from Game of Thrones. So they pick from directors who are actually able to deliver the product, but not exactly well-known big names. So they're probably going like, who's the best director fit for the property? And then go from there. And, you know, that would probably take 65 tries to actually do that. I don't see that as being excessive. Just see them as doing their due diligence and making sure no stone is uncovered.
True. And yep, because they've had very little bad luck in terms of directors. I mean, they went through one or two before they decided on Taylor for Dark World and obviously Edgar Wright. But outside of that, they haven't had any really like big notable shakeups after they have announced a director. And they certainly are doing a much better job of it than, say, the Star Wars franchise right now.
Maybe it's just like Kevin Feige could call, like, you know, Kathleen Kennedy over for a cup of coffee. Here, let's talk. Let me see this. Here, don't replace your director during the production, okay? Because that's tacky, okay? You can't do that. Mm-hmm. Do it beforehand. Or better yet, force them out. That's the best way to do it, Kathleen. and also, I think, wasn't like Nick Cassavetes up for directing Iron Man? But I don't know if like he was up for it before it came back to Marvel or after.
I think it was before it came back to Marvel.
Okay. It was still at Paramount, was it?
It was at Paramount.
And like since the Edgar Wright thing, I think they've actually become more gun-shy about that. And that might be part of the reason why they're doing the due diligence, if it is true, for the Black Widow director. They want to make sure they got somebody who's on the same page as them, but who could bring their own style to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like the director for Thor Ragnarok, whose name I do know, but I'm not even going to bother try to pronounce because...
Taika Waititi?
Yes, exactly. That him. but he was like kind of unknown, but perfect fit for Joe Public probably doesn't know who he is. Doesn't know where he came from.
Yeah, comedy fans know him for Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, yeah.
I know him from a couple of like small films like Hunt for the Wilder People and
or Eagle, Seven Stages.
Eagle versus Shark. And he does show up in this the Kate Micucci comedy Seven Stages to Achieving Eternal Bliss
as by passing through the gateway chosen by the Holy Storch.
Yes, which we talked about last week in the Tribeca roundup, and he's hilarious in that, by the way, as you would expect.
Not he didn't direct like Hunt for Red October. He didn't direct the last Star Wars movie. He didn't direct Jurassic Park 17.
Mm-hmm.
The dinosaurs get a dentist. He, a lot of people didn't know about him, but I mean, honestly,
the lost filling.
Lost filling.
I hate myself for that joke.
Yes. Yes, but when the Pirates of the Caribbean lose a tooth, people don't die.
oh, God.
But he was the perfect tone for that. And he, mm-hmm. he brought life into a character that, as you said at the beginning of this, Wanda Lay, mm-hmm. Thor was kind of iffy kind of thing. But that was the perfect Thor. That was entertaining Thor. That was a fun Thor movie. And it was what he brought to it. His design, his style, the design, everything like that. Perfect director for the perfect character. And it took three movies to get to it. And that's what kind of makes me kind of sad. If it is true, this is the last Thor movie, because I want to see a new Thor movie now and I might not get it. Fooey.
I'm with you there. I want to see, Taika Waititi do another Thor movie. And I certainly felt after Dark World that I never wanted to see another Thor movie.
Oh, yeah.
So to, swing that pendulum for me like that is amazing on behalf of Marvel.
So are we all on the same page with the Thor Dark World being maybe the worst Marvel movie? I mean, it's still watchable. All right.
If not the worst, then that has to go to the Incredible Hulk movie.
See, I would put Incredible Hulk above that just a little bit.
It has Tim Roth, so it gets a little leeway.
I was going to say, and that I think wraps us up for this week.
All right.
Yeah.
Bill, thank you so much for taking a portion of your Sunday morning out, now inching into Sunday afternoon, to join us for this. I really appreciate it. And we urge, of course, listeners to check out Bill's stuff at Film Buff Online, where he's written extensively about Avengers Infinity War over the last week.
Yes, almost too extensively. if you're not sick of articles about Avengers Infinity War yet, come to our site and read my stuff, and we'll take care of that for you.
We're going to have a little talk later on about how you promote your work, dude.
Yes. Okay. I'll be waiting for you by the woodshed. Whenever you're done here, just come back out there.
Make sure you get the wood chipper out.
I want to say thank you for having me on. This was a blast. I heard you guys doing this. I'm like, curses, I wish I lived in Pennsylvania. And I'm glad to be finally part of it. And invite me again, please. It was very fun.
Of course. We'll look for another silly reason to have you on real soon.
Yes.
Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Yes. There we go. Remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes and Stitcher. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review, because that always helps us connect with new listeners.
We'll be back next week with more news analysis and reviews on the Big Picture Podcast.